Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
2023, you guys, and I'm winging it. Hi, it's Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. That's the website, The Dork Forest, if you like a determiner. Dorkforest.com also works. JackieCation.com has all of my stand-up information. Like, it has videos, it has pictures, it has links to this podcast and to my other podcast with Lori Kilmartin. It has a merch store that has Dork Forest t-shirts. It has all of my stand-up merch and all of my CDs and DVDs. So, that's what you know about websites. There's an opportunity, because we're in the new year here, that you can donate to the Dork Forest. I don't have a Patreon. I don't have anything really set up, though I understand you can set up on PayPal a monthly if you wanted to. You could donate and be of to support the show. This is the 17th season, the 17th year I've been putting this stuff out. It's free, but if you have money and would like to throw me some money, boy, howdy. There's a PayPal, there is at my email address, actually, jackie@jackiecation.com, which you can also email me and tell me how much you're enjoying the show. You can also do Venmo if you'd like, which is just Jackie Cation, no hyphen, all one word, picture of this person, me. And then I think that's it. I think I have Zelle, but it's too complicated. Other than that, let's do the credits. Patrick Brady, still in, fixing the audio all these years later. Give it up to Patrick Brady. That's what a lot of your donations support, by the way, because I like to share the wealth. And then Vilmos, he does the websites. And Mike Rickberg wrote and sang that song. Composed and sang that song with his wife now, Sarah. And at the end, he sings the Mexican Hat Dance, which is always fun. Anyway, I'm sure there's more to it. There's a band camp that has a bunch. It has like a stand-up storytelling album that was never released. It's there's also a bunch of live episodes that many of them are free. There were 200 episodes that were not pre-recorded, and I sort of culled through those, and I pulled like 17 of the best ones. There's an album collection of that, 17 hours of Dork Forest. If you run through all of the episodes, go to bandcamp.com, Dork Forest, or Google those words, and you'll find it. Anyway, there's probably more. I can't remember any of it, but you're doing great. Feel free to enjoy the show.
Oh my gosh, Jackie Cation, I am in my garage. It couldn't happen to a nicer person. But with me to do the Dork Forest, another nicer person. It's Mike Kaplan. Welcome back to the show, Mike Kaplan.
Thank you for having me. I love talking to you. That was a delightful introduction to yourself, by yourself. Thank you.
Well, I'm there for myself, and that's the important thing. That's truly where I'm at in life. Mike Kaplan, by the way, spelled MYQKAPLAN, and it's at Mike Kaplan on everything. He has a new Dry Bar special coming out in 2 days. That'll be, I think, the middle of May of 2023. It's on Dry Bar.
Yes.
If you use the code Mike Kaplan, or Mike, just Mike, right? M-Y-Q?
Yes, just M-Y-Q on the Dry Bar Comedy Plus app. Look for the app, and it'll get you a free month, and then it'll help me if you also forget to unsign up for it, which you're certainly welcome to do. But if you accidentally leave it there for years, it'll really help me a lot.
And then you're going to Edinburgh in August to do with the bit did it, probably some mime. You're going to do a little physical work.
Yes. I've come on this podcast to talk about how when I go 25 days in a row, maybe even more, I don't know.
You will be silent.
I will be doing... Yeah, the John Cage of comedy, they call me. 25 Edinburghs of silence.
Mike Kaplan also has 1 million comedy albums. The current one is called Live in Between Albums, and you should always listen to all of them. So there you go. Is there a Mike Kaplan? It's at Mike Kaplan on Instagram and all the things, but is there a MikeKaplan.com? I forgot to ask.
There is. It seems like, I mean, I don't pay attention to who goes there, but I definitely hardly go to websites anymore.
I go to websites. I like to see where people are, what's happening. I get a little jealous. I'm not going to lie to you. so I will say this, is that Let's dork out, though. You have dorked yes. out several times on this program. Your current topic, my friend, is Buddhism.
Yes.
Not, by the way, I just talked about, before I even let you talk, I'm going to tell you a story. I just talked to my dad as I was doing errands right before this, and he said, you know, I once had a lead at a nudist colony. And I said, not nudism, Dad, Buddhism. He didn't hear me. He's 86. And so he said, so it was in Burlington, and I show up, and I was like, do I have to take off my clothes to pitch for you guys to buy? And they said, no. And he said, because I'm keeping an awning. Anyway, so one awning. Not nudism.
I love it.
I love it all.
I mean, sounds like for certain audiences at a nudist colony or a naturalist event of any kind, like certain things might be very easy to sell to, like, hey, is anyone there feeling uncomfortable with the choices that they've made? Here's a tie.
Right. I did say when he said nudist colony, I said, and they asked him to take his clothes. I said, were you hoping? Were you hoping? Because he was working the angles. He's always working the angles.
Oh, yes. But Buddhism, I mean, you know, there's certainly a commonality in perhaps maybe minimalism is, you know, the Venn diagram overlap, where my understanding is that certain Buddhist monks who take, you know, take vows, there's vows of poverty similar, you know, I don't know if they call it that, but there are Buddhists who only own, I think, four things. They only want to own four things.
My dog has an issue. There you go. You came in, you stupid. Pardon me while I call my own dog stupid. He's not
That's
right.
That's fair.
This is Tyson, and Tyson doesn't like it when the door isn't wide open. We all like a wide open door. We feel more welcome, don't we? So, yeah, so Buddhism, I missed the last 30 seconds of what you just said like a jackass.
It's funny because I started talking about minimalism, and it's something that I strive for and do not, you know, verge on very frequently in the words that I use, in the things that I own. Like, my girlfriend and I are moving in the process of packing up all our stuff in the next couple of weeks. So we're like, what things do we need? All of them? More than all of them? This thing? But
more
we're doing our best to
them.
Be like, yeah, I'm like, Look, I've got all of these books, many of them about Buddhism, some of which I've read, many of which I've intended to read for the 17 years that I've owned them.
Sure.
I'm like, any lifetime now. But the thing I was saying while here's the thing. You were caring for a sentient being, Tyson the dog.
Tyson the dog.
In Buddhism, cool thing, they say, you know, some people... I feel like there's been lots of jokes over the years. You've done comedy a lot. You've seen a lot of jokes. From both perspectives of, like, people who love animals, people who don't love how much people love animals. Like here's a trope. He thinks he's people, you know, or people who refer to their animals as their babies of kinds.
A joke because my mother-in-law refers to my dog as that I am that dog's mother. But all that does is open a door for me to be able to say, I've never slept with a dog. Do you want to hear the story of how close I came?
I love it. And yes, if you're asking me, I'd be happy to hear it. Or if that's just part of the joke, I'm happy to not hear it.
It's incredibly not. And then it isn't about that. It's just the closest. I never came even close. All I did was ask a guy named Dino if he was named after the dog in the Flintstones. And he said, I'm Greek, you idiot. That's the end of the joke. Right there. There's not a lot to it.
You heard it here, seventh. And... So this is all to say, in Buddhism, in conventional Western parlance, in the culture that I was raised and I imagine you were raised, we think of there's humans and there's animals. And then if you're like, well, technically a human is an animal.
Right.
So really, like in the, you know, the stratification that we may have learned in a science class. Like,
I was taught that humans were animals and... And it was leaned into. I don't know why. I blame the 70s. So,
And it's absolutely true. That is, it is true. And there's a world in which if somebody says humans and animals, we understand them. We're not like, don't you mean humans and other animals?
Oh, there's a pedant out there who wants to say those words to us. Yes.
And so, yes, we understand conventionally that when you say humans and animals, you mean humans and non-human animals. And also, Buddhism flips the script. In Buddhism, the way the dividing hierarchy works is persons include humans and all of what we think of as non-human animals. A horse is a person. A dog is a person. A bug is a person.
Wait a minute.
Not a human person.
In the original language that the Buddhist... First of all, I love that we're a good 5-6 minutes in and I have to... And then rewind. Because I'm here with Mike Kaplan talking about Buddhism. First of all, what I know about Buddhism, you can imagine, is very much a middle-aged white lady's knowledge of Buddhism, which very easily could be Taoism. So let us talk about, is there scripture? Who started it? There's a skinny Buddha. There's a fat Buddha. I've seen the statues. That's what I know. What do we know?
Ha.
Let's start at the beginning briefly, and then I do want to go back to the personhood.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm going to address, okay, a lot of what I've learned about Buddhism. And number one, kudos to you on knowing that Buddhism and Taoism are different. Like, you're already ahead of the game. My friend Gus, a dear friend of mine, is a practicing Buddhist. A joke that I tell sometimes, almost exclusively on podcasts about Buddhism, is... For this reason, because I've been learning a lot about Buddhism. The joke that I tell on stage is I've been learning a lot about Buddhism from Instagram and bumper stickers like you do. The truth is that I've been learning a lot from my friend Gus, a practicing Buddhist. So I've been learning a lot about it. I really like it. One of the main ideas of it is that the goal, if there's a goal for many Buddhists, is to eliminate suffering, to decrease suffering and increase happiness for all sentient beings. Like, that's the main thing that most of us are striving to do anyway.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Like if you're not a monster, that should be the end game for any religious or non-religious person. There you go.
Exactly. And in fact, I'll probably refer to this at various points, but I'm reading this book, or I just finished this book right now called Zen. Oop, you can't, let's see if you can see it. Yeah, Zen is right here. And it's by Shunryu Suzuki. It's the wisdom of him as presented by others. And one thing that he says in it is that to non-Buddhists, there are Buddhists and non-Buddhists. But to a Buddhist, everyone is a Buddhist, including bugs.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Okay. We all, certainly, almost every being that you can imagine that we know wants to increase happiness for themselves, wants to decrease suffering for themselves. That's what we want: more happiness, less suffering. And then the goal eventually
is ground zero. Yeah, you're talking ground zero, increase happiness, decrease suffering, ground zero.
And then, you know, maybe you include your family in that. Maybe you include your loved ones, your neighborhood, your community. And ultimately, you know, the Buddha or a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, my understanding is, which is like sort of a peaceful, you know, the equivalent of a warrior, but not for peace instead of war. Like, they are people who are trying to help everyone achieve that, trying to help everyone gain happiness and decrease suffering. And it's said that they might love everyone in the world, every sentient being, the same way that a loving mother loves a child. Just every sentient being gets that, all the love.
Couple of things. First of all, these are the best stand-up comics for me. And second of all, I like the qualification of a loving mother, because an angry mother or a resentful mother, less positive.
Yeah, they do their best to cover their bases.
Yeah.
Here's the reason I bring up Gus, my Buddhist friend, who is the source. Ah, yes. Okay. So the joke that I tell on podcasts is sometimes when I talk about Buddhism as extensively as I do, people ask me reasonably, are you a Buddhist? And I say, no, I'm not a practicing Buddhist. But are you familiar with Mitch Hedberg's joke about, he's like, People sometimes ask me if you have, I have a girlfriend. I say, like, I don't have a girlfriend, but I do know a woman who'd be real mad if she heard me say that.
Yes.
So, love Mitch Hedberg, love that joke. Mm-hmm. And I feel this way. Like,
boy,
I'm
was
not
his
a
girlfriend mad, by the way, when he married that woman. That other woman? Anyway.
The other Lynn with a different number of N's, I believe. Yes.
Yes.
So I am not a practicing Buddhist, but I think that there's a Buddha somewhere out there who would be pretty fine with me either way if he heard me say that. So.
Buddha seems to be a good sport.
Yeah, maybe the best sport. So Gus recently a friend of mine, a comedian friend, wrote a joke about Buddhism, shared it with me. I shared it with my Buddhist friend Gus, and he said, there are some things about this that I feel like are inaccurate based on my understanding.
Okay.
As so many of us, I've written many jokes about Buddhism over the years that were absolutely based on caricatures that are incorrect.
I've written jokes about meat and vegetables that were inaccurate. So why stop there?
But here's the thing. One of the classic things that so many of us think and see we believe are true about Buddhism is that Buddha was fat, which he was not. I mean, there are many different Buddhas. There's maybe infinite Buddhas, but the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the classic, the main Buddha that we think of when we think of the Buddha, who's like the originator of, in this timeline, many of the stories and the teachings, 84,000 or so, I believe, that he didn't write down, that was transferred, you know, orally from the thousands of years ago that he lived. But eventually people codified it. Somebody was like, I think it would be good to write these down for people to spread them to people who want them other places than where you can hear.
Then why is he pictured as heavier, shall we say?
Here's the reason. I'm going to read to you from a text.
Ooh.
From Gus.
This is a Dork Forest classic, you guys. We're pulling up a text. We're reading from it. Let's hear it.
Got it. So Gus, to me, on the subject, he says, the Buddha was never fat at any point in his lifetime. He was famously extremely skinny at one point. That's how he discovered the middle path. He nearly died of starvation, realized that would have accomplished nothing. And he was of unremarkable, as far as I know, as far as Gus knows, unremarkable weight at other times, but never fat. The idea that he was fat is a Western misconception, which arose like this. In China, there was a monk named Budai, B-U-D-A-I. It's spelled here with some accents over several of the vowels. He was fat and happy. Over time, it became accepted in China that Budai was a manifestation of a different Buddha, Maitreya Buddha. Note well, not Shakyamuni Buddha. So he became known as the happy Buddha. Gus adds in parentheses, kind of like the unmarried bachelor, I guess. So the similarity of the name Budai to the word Buddha is sheer coincidence to our Western ears. Buddha is the Sanskrit word we adopted for referring to Shakyamuni. And the Chinese word for Buddha, I'm told, is Fu, which sounds nothing like Budai. But when Westerners were exposed to a figure named Budai and told this was the happy Buddha, they seem to have assumed that Budai is my guess. That was a funny way of pronouncing Buddha.
Okay. This feels very Coca-Cola Santa Claus. So
100%.
Yeah. So there you go. So now who the teacher, and this is not to fat shame anyone, by the way, this discussion of weight, it's all good. So we love you however size I am and you are. So there you go. So the question remains, who was the original person who was attributed to being the Buddha?
Yes.
I do. I've always wondered this. Have you have any idea?
Yeah. Shakyamuni Buddha is the one who we think of as Buddha. Gautama is also a name associated therewith. Like, okay, if you go to, I'm going to briefly go to the source of all important information, Wikipedia. And
even if you're writing papers, I'm going to need a second source on my desk.
Yes. So there is a Wikipedia page for the _Buddha, and that is Siddhartha Gautama, who lived in South Asia during the 6th or 5th century BCE, and is considered the founder of Buddhism.
Okay.
And then he was born to royal parents of the Shakya clan, and that is why I believe he was eventually called Shakyamuni Buddha. But also, let me say, as not a Buddha, but someone, big fan of Buddhism and all the Buddhas that I'm aware of. So any of this is going, all this is filtered through my, you know, flawed, as far as I know, I am not yet a divinely enlightened Buddha master. So some of what I say may be inaccurate, but
right.
My understanding is that
you just think it's fascinating and really cool.
Buddhism. And practical.
And practical.
Absolutely.
And practical.
Yes.
What is 100%. The practical application of what you know of Buddhism?
Sure, sure. Well, with the goal being the increase, so I guess let's get to the Four Noble Truths, which are kind of like the greatest hits of Buddhism.
Okay.
Like, there are many, many teachings, and there are many different schools of Buddhism, but classic among, I think, all, if not all, most, the Four Noble Truths. The first truth, essentially, is that there is suffering, which could get, in life, there is suffering. Many people, I think most people would agree. Some people mistake this for all things are suffering, which that is, I think, an overreach. That is an overextension. But definitely.
Oh, because there's the statement there is suffering is just a statement. That is a noble truth, but it doesn't put anything on anyone.
No, but it should be something that we all, I mean, look within yourself and have you ever suffered? Then you can agree that there is suffering somewhere in the space-time continuum.
Right, yeah. But you say that some people misunderstand it and say that there is always suffering or all beings suffer.
Yeah,
and that's not what to your knowledge, the Buddhist truth is, noble truth is.
Yes. I mean, I would say that for people who are not Buddhas, that it is probably true that I'd say that all beings do suffer at times. In fact, maybe even a lot of the time in this cyclic, you know, existence that we seem to be like, you know, depending on. You don't have to believe in rebirths and reincarnation to find value in the teachings of Buddhism, but there are many Buddhists and teachings that do talk about rebirths and that a human life is a precious one because it's one where we can do a lot. Like there's godly realms that are like much more joyous than ours,
mm-hmm.
and there are hellish realms that are much less joyous than ours, but ours has, you know, some of both, but also the capacity, a greater capacity to follow the path to make it so that we don't continually be reborn in the more hellish realms.
Okay. So noble truth one, there is suffering. We will get
suffering.
To reincarnation. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, if not in this podcast, in the next podcast that is reborn out of this one. There's a framing of the Four Noble Truths that I like. Let me see if I can get it. It's sort of like the way that a doctor, like, I think it's like the symptoms. The symptoms are suffering. Number two, the causes of suffering. That's the noble truth. Number two, the causes of suffering. And that is the diagnosis. So there's the symptoms. There's the diagnosis. And then number three, and it's funny, my friend Gus once taught a class on the Four Noble Truths, and a man fell asleep after he heard only the first noble truth, didn't hear that there were others. He was like, oh, there is suffering. Got it. Left, never came back. So Gus always wants people to know there are more. It's not just that one. And in fact, the third noble truth is the end of suffering, that there is or can be an end to suffering. And number four is the path to the end of suffering, the steps that one can take, which is often called, I think, the Noble Eightfold Path.
The path to end suffering?
Yeah, the path to the cessation of suffering, it's often called.
Okay. So these aren't necessarily truths in sort of an English Western kind of thing. Like, there is suffering felt like just sort of a truth. The cause of suffering does indeed feel like we're going to look for some symptoms. Like you said.
Yes.
So, and the end of suffering is that sort of a recipe to how to treat it?
Yes. Often, the prescription in the medical model. And then I guess the path is ongoing service. Yeah. Or the treatment or the medicine or, the prescription and then the taking of the medicine that then leads to the end of the ailment.
What book is there a Buddhist book like the Tao? Is it the Upanishads or is the Bhagavad Gita or is it something like that?
So I've heard of all these. I know the Bhagavad Gita is Hindu, I believe.
Yes.
So
I've read all of them, by the way, because I took classes in college. So you know in your heart that I read them 30 years ago and I probably skimmed them while drunk. So there you go.
And so I've heard of the Upanishads. I think they may also be more Hindu related, but the text that I am familiar with that, again, Buddha didn't write the particular Buddha that we're talking about didn't write things down. But one of the ways they've been collected over the years, there is a text called the Lam Rim, L-A-M space R-I-M. And that is, a textual form that presents the stages, like basically the steps to like from you don't know anything about Buddhism, you don't know anything about ending suffering to getting all the way to the end of suffering.
Okay. Wow. And how about now here's I'm just gonna keep throwing things out. The things that I know. Confucius.
Yes.
Who the hell is he?
Not a Buddhist, I think.
There we go.
I think
now we can write him off for a different episode of The Dork Forest. Okay.
Yes.
Now, let us go back to personhood.
Yes.
So, in Buddhism, there is personhood.
Yes. And I think it's the question that you were asking, like, as to whether it's a different translation of the word. I mean, in one of the ways in which I have been learning about Buddhism is through a process, through a modality called Tibetan debate. Tibetan debate, like not all Buddhism is Tibetan, but there is Tibetan Buddhism. And in Tibetan debate, which I've been learning with my friend Gus, one thing, like you don't need to know anything about Buddhism to learn the mechanisms and the methodology of this debate process, but the book that we're reading does offer like specific Buddhist examples. Like, for example, here's a hierarchy. Before I get to the hierarchy, there's three, I don't know what these three things are called, but the three main things in Buddhism that if you can glean any of them, you're pretty good. You're like kind of set, but definitely if you get them all. And those three things are, one is called dukkha, which translates to suffering sometimes, but sometimes it gets translated as like more discomfort. And because when we think of suffering, we think of like, wah, I'm sad often, or I'm hurt. But there are different sufferings, like even when something feels good, like knowing that it's not going to last is a form of suffering as well. Like when we're like, I got the thing that I wanted, and yet now, you know, like actually I recorded my dry bar special in September of 2021. And I think they told me, they're like, usually it's like 6 to 9 months until it comes out. And it wasn't, it's been a year and a half. But so at a certain point I was like, oh, when's it going to happen? I want it to come out. I am excited. I want people to hear it. So that's that lack, that sort of coming from a place of, you know, not abundantly like, oh, everything, like it's fine. I was fine. It wasn't hurting me that it wasn't coming out.
Right.
And yet still.
Yeah.
And now I just got the email yesterday. It's coming out next week. And here are some things that you can do to help like spread the word and promote. And I was like, oh, and now more, it's like you climbed a mountain and now as a reward, you get to climb down the mountain and up another mountain and mountains all the way up.
Right. You know? Right. Well, and the expectations and the whole, you know, lateral discussion, of course, is the expectations when you, like, the dry bar thing will be what is called in stand-up comedy passive income, right? Mm-hmm. It will eventually pay you, which is why a year and a half later, you're like, it'd be great if that came out. And if you're not freaking out about it, it would be better because, you know, in the interim, like when all of my albums went off of Pandora and Spotify and XM Sirius, it cut essentially a third of my income. When I stopped working for Maria for about a year and a half, Maria Bamford loves to overpay me. That was probably another third of my income. You know what I learned, Mike Kaplan? I can live on a third of my income.
Ha!
Because I am still living indoors. And I have, you know, there's food in the fridge and I can buy a book if I want to read a novel. I don't have to sweat it.
Yeah. Fantastic. You could buy a copy of the Upanishads if you want.
I own a copy.
Bone up.
But there it is. Oh. Gathering dust. There it is.
that's, I think that's a wonderful attitude. And yeah, exactly. Sometimes they call it getting hooked, depending who is using what language. Like on these things that are sometimes called kleshas, which are the things that make us like, oh no, the thing like desire, the things that we want that we don't have that we think would make us happy, even though when we get them, then they bring along with them other things that, you know, because there is no end point, there is no reaching the horizon of like once I'm there, then I'm good forever. And
right.
So that's the first one of these things, of these three things that probably have a name that I don't know, is suffering. And these aren't in an order. So one of them is suffering. One of them is impermanence, which we can glean pretty easily as well. Like the idea, like look at yourself in the mirror today. Look at a picture of yourself from a year ago, from 10 years ago, from 30 years ago. We are impermanent. Look at, you know, a penny today. Look at it. Look at that same penny right when it came out of the factory. Look at that penny a year from now. And we can see everything, like there are in Buddha. Okay, so I'll get back to here comes. This is where on stage I would say one time I was heckled by a lady who just said focus. And now she's my mentor. So the third thing, so suffering, impermanence, and then selflessness, that all things lack a self, that nothing has a permanent, intrinsic, unchanging self. Like that's like when people, and this is the one that also gets sort of misunderstood by myself in the past and sometimes still, the idea that like that we, if we say, oh, I don't have a self, well then who's saying that I don't have a self? It's not that there's nothing here. Like the middle path in Buddhism is, I think, often one manifestation of it is that sometimes when people hear that there is no self, they're like, oh, so there's nothing, nihilism. On the other side, the opposite mistake is to think that there is a permanent self, like an eternal soul. In Buddhism, no eternal soul. There is no God, no eternal soul. There are gods of a kind in the godly realm, but let's leave them aside for now. It'd be better to use a different word. But here's a cool thing that I like about Buddhism before I get back into everything. When I was raised Jewish. I learned about Judaism. I learned about Christianity by it being everywhere. And I remember having the question, you know, classic gotcha question for a philosophy student or a child, you know, or any who among us hasn't thought like, well, if God's all powerful and all loving, if there's a loving God that's all powerful, then why is there suffering? Mic drop, atheism, you know? And the way that Buddhism answers this question is beautiful and makes a lot of sense to me, is that the Buddha, all Buddhas are said to be, number one, omniscient, all-knowing. Number two, omnibenevolent, all-loving. Number three, omnipresent, all places. Number four, specifically not omnipotent, not all-powerful, because if the Buddha was all-powerful, then absolutely, snap, everyone's suffering is gone, but we all have to do it. There's a thing that they say, that I think the Buddha said, or somebody purported to be the Buddha, that the bucket is not filled by the last drop and the bucket is not filled by the first drop. The bucket is filled by each drop. Each one of us can only, like Ram Dass, not specifically Buddhist, but another spiritual teacher that I feel like is Buddhism adjacent. He has said, like, the best thing that I can do for you is work on myself. And, you know, that's a great place to start. Pema Chodron, an American Buddhist nun, has a book, Start Where You Are. Like, the only place there is, where you are, that's the place to start. The book I'm reading right now, Zen is Right Here, Shunryu Suzuki. Somebody asked him, if Zen is everywhere, why do we have to come to the Zen training place? And the answer is like, well, Zen is everywhere, but for you, Zen is right here. Like, wherever you are, that's the place. That's the place to start. And so you can work on eliminating your suffering. And, you know, the same way that, of course, like when we know about the suffering of others, that can hopefully, it might make us suffer ourselves, or it can also motivate us to help others, help ourselves. And one of the explanations of there being no self is that in some ways I think that's where the concept of we are all oneness comes from, which might even not be, I think it's not a thing that the Buddha said specifically. It's just more of a modernism, but that there is that everything. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk who died in the past year or two, wonderful, lots of bangers, wonderful books, how to fight, how to relax, how to walk, how to eat, how to this, how to that. He talked of a concept called interbeing, like, and he would say that all things inter are. Like, a flower can't exist without dirt, without water, without sunlight. A flower can't exist without a bee. A bee can't exist without a flower. The bee and the flower inter are. I can't exist without food, without air, without trees, without sunlight, without the earth. We all inter are. There's no one that can exist on their own. And in fact, you know, you might know that all of our molecules, all of our cells, all of our atoms, like, they're not made of the same stuff from moment to moment. Like, we are all constantly, like, you probably got some of my atoms from hanging out with me at some point.
Who was it? I read his book, too. He was, no doubt on Oprah. One of the great talking heads of Be a Decent Person guy. And I believe...
Eckhart Tolle?
Nope. It's...
Deepak Chopra?
Deepak Chopra. That's it. Yeah. And thank you for playing this episode of Mad Libs or whatever. But Deepak Chopra was the one who pointed out, because he's a medical doctor, in addition to being...
Yes.
Sort of a pep talk guy. And mm-hmm. That's what I think of those guys. I think of they're giving you a pep talk. And
Dr. Pep Talk, yeah.
So here's my next question, though, is so if Buddhism doesn't, if it has gods in some adjacent dork forest we're not going to go to, is it a religion?
So this gets to, I feel like all of your questions are pointing at this question or the topic of definitions, which when I started talking about Tibetan debate, one of the things that I learned about was the definitions in Buddhism of many things.
Okay.
That ultimately, when you're using language, like at some point, definitions will become circular, because to define words with other words, then you look up those words and you're like, wait, but what's the first one? How do we know what the word blue even means? And you're like, well, look at that, you know? So they do their best, words do. And yes. So they do meticulously define words and concepts in Buddhism. So like the question of what is a person and what qualifies, what fits in that category. And so even the question of what is a religion? Like, I think that the question of what is a religion, which probably on another dark forest, you and I discussed linguistics, which is something that I
also
studied.
Yeah.
And so technically I am a master of linguistics, which, and even the word master, it itself means many things. It's funny that there are doctors of linguistics who are technically more powerful in linguistics than I, but master sounds like I'm more powerful. So this is all to say, I think that the same way, I mean, let's take Judaism. Is Judaism a religion? Surely yes, but the way that many Jews are Jews? No. Like, there are many Jews that are like, yeah, I mean, like, I don't do any of the things. Like, because religions offer many things. Religions offer community. Religions offer potentially a code of ethics. Religion offers, you know, rituals, you know, some ways of living. It's funny, like, I feel like somebody asked me once, I was like, no, this is a joke. I asked myself. A joke idea that I have of, like, where the Bible came from, like, everything that's in the Bible. Because there's some things that are, like, real cool. Like, hey, like, maybe don't murder? Yeah. Absolutely, on board. Mm-hmm. And then they're sometimes, like, maybe don't wear clothing that has different kinds of fibers in it. And I'm like, I don't think that that one's on the same level as the other one.
I mean, but each one had a reason. But one reason, currently moot. Yes.
And so I feel like whoever came up with, you know, the rules in the Bible, it's as if somebody asked, like, okay, so what's the best way to live? And they're like, okay, don't kill, don't steal, don't this, don't that. And then they're like, okay, keep going. And like, I guess, well, I don't, my things are just all one fiber. So if you're asking how I live, how do I live? That's how I live.
Right.
It's very simple. And this gets back to the very beginning, briefly. I'll button off one thing that I started to say before a person that is your dog was needed care, that you expressed increasing the dog's happiness and your own and mine. Very Buddhist of you. There are some Buddhist monks. This is the thing that for 30 seconds while you were attending to the dog, you did not hear, I think. There are some Buddhist monks that take vows to not own anything more than they need, and so they only own four basic things. They own a bowl for food. They own shoes, or like a pair of shoes for walking around. They own a robe, or maybe an extra robe to be able to like wear when they're washing their first robe. But like robe, shoes, bowl. And then the final item, I believe, is a permissible item is a little broom or a little implement to sweep bugs out of your path as you're walking so that you do not accidentally murder extra bugs.
Wow. The care of bugs is interesting to me. Yes. I remember, you know, we all read about the kids that take a magnifying glass and kill bugs. And yes, as a sign of troubled youth. That is a troubled human that is about to continue living. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to avoid, I have no idea who taught me this, is to avoid stepping on ant. And I hate ants. I used to not care about ants and would just avoid ants. I don't know how I was taught to avoid killing bugs if I didn't need to kill bugs. Might have been my grandmother who said, no, they're helping the garden. Leave them alone. And then I used to have a recurring nightmare where spiders fell from the ceiling all over me. And that would wake me up yelling. Now, because I don't... Spiders are a lot for me. For some reason, I didn't like them. But then I had what someone told me was called a lucid dream. I felt special. But it was a dream where I was having that nightmare, and all I could think was, this is a nightmare. And I was like, hey, spiders, can we have some sort of social agreement where you don't get on me? Like, I won't kill you if you... And the dream changed immediately to the parting of the ways, and all the spiders fell on the floor. And since then, I have a social contract with spiders. And that is, if you are outside, you get to live. I don't want to look at you move. It creeps me out. But if you are indoors and I can find somebody to take you outdoors, that's great. But I might have to kill you. And I am so sorry because I can't live in a house with a spider. It's too much. But I don't have a lot of spiders in my house. And it's almost like the spiders are like, no, we get it. So, you know, I mean, there's people that I don't hang out with who find me not, I'm too much. They don't want any part of me.
Yeah, we don't have to go too far in this direction, but sadly, there are people who have that policy with certain people. Like, if you hopefully you stay out of my house and I don't swat you like a spider, but you come too near and ring the doorbell accidentally of my house, I spider you.
Oh, right, right. That feels like let's use an example from my childhood, Vicky Emberts. She beat me up a couple of times. I didn't do anything. She just had some beating up to do. And I happened to be in the way. So for many years, just hated her, and would avoid her. And if I saw her today, I would probably avoid her, though I think everyone 40 years later might be given some slack. She probably changed. But if she showed up at my door, there would not be a problem there. I would have to say, let's talk about it outside. I wouldn't invite her to the house.
Oh, yeah. There's a Buddhist wise person named Shantideva. And Shantideva said this thing that I'll try to paraphrase. It's like, if someone hits us with a stick, most of us don't get mad at the stick. Because we understand that the stick is just being caused to, like, the stick is the thing that's hitting us and hurting us, but the stick isn't trying to do it, it was caused to do it. Now, the trickier part is, he's like, the person doing that is also like the stick. Like, you can go back and trace the causes and conditions of their state of being today, to their childhood, to their parents, they were a baby, and the baby that they were experienced things, and sometimes they go back to other lifetimes also, back to beginningless time, but you don't even have to go that far, like, to be like, oh yeah, a baby, I'm generally not mad at a baby, and the baby received treatment that it wasn't asking for, that it didn't, sign up for, and then it became that person. At every step of the way, the baby was caused to become the person who hit a person with a stick.
Right.
And it's not to say, like, that doesn't mean keep hanging out with that person. Like, definitely, like, leave, get away from that person.
Right. Step away from the stick that is a person. And I, in a lateral move, would say, this is the argument people use with guns, is that sticks should still be available and guns should still be available. But it's a ranged weapon. I say, melee weapons, sure, those should still be available. Ranged weapons, this is someone using a stick person using something to affect things too far away from them. Make them think locally. I don't want them to affect globally.
I understand. I'm on board. And a question that sometimes arises when this story is told. Okay, so I'm not supposed to be mad at, I'm not mad at the stick. Okay, don't get mad at the person either, because you can understand that they are also like the stick. Well, then I'm mad. Who am I supposed to be mad at? And the answer is the delusion. The delusion that everyone is under. In fact, the person hitting you with the stick is more under. Again, not to say
you shouldn't
with an
step
abuser.
Away from yeah. the abuser. Yes.
Yeah. You can, you can understand from a distance.
Right. Horrible story.
But, yes.
I lost my temper once, and I grabbed a woman by her shirt. This is me as an adult in the last 20 years. Yeah. And that woman, luckily for everyone, was a bus driver. So she knew how to deal with the unstable. And she said to me, "You're not going to hit me." And I let go of her, and I said, "Of course not." And then we awkwardly stood there. And then I got to say moments later, "I am so sorry for losing my mind." And she said, "I'm glad it's over." And she didn't say, "Oh, don't worry about it." Nobody's ever said, "Don't worry about it," when I've lost my temper and done something crazy. Everyone who I've apologized to has been like, "Oh, good. I'm glad you realized that that was nuts."
It's a good way to accept an apology is to say thank you.
Yes.
That it honors, especially if it's a legitimate apology that isn't, disclaiming.
Yeah.
If you're like, "Oh, I regret what I did. I made a mistake.
I'm going to try not to do that again."
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've learned a thing. Can I make it up to you in some way? Thank you.
And then thank you is a good response. And
yeah.
Yeah, nobody's. Yeah. I've had at least three people say thank you. Which means that I've made three mistakes that I've had to go back and apologize for, you guys.
Three is pretty good.
Yeah. We're close to like 10 minutes left. And this, yes. You know, Buddhism, we're talking thousands of years old. Oh. So let's touch
base. I'll wrap up some ideas. And first I'll say also, to be continued, of course, in many podcasts, Infinite Lifetimes, my friend Gus, the Buddhist, was on my podcast. I recommend that podcast episode. We don't extensively talk about Buddhism, but I've taken classes that he has taught that are all like 2 hours long for like 7 weeks. So there was no way we were going to get, you know, 84,000 teachings in 1 hour, but I will get to this. So the idea that there is no permanent self, which we can really understand based on like the mood that we have now is not the mood that we had yesterday. We don't even remember many of our experiences from when we were a baby, when we were a child, even what'd you have for lunch on Tuesday last week? Who knows? We are that there is impermanence, that, you know, moment to moment, everything is changing, that there is, including the thing that we think of as our conventional self. We're like, it makes sense in convention to be like, oh, yeah, you're Jackie. I'm Mike. I get it. But also, at a certain point, this material that is Mike and the material that is Jackie will be, it'll be called different stuff. It will maybe not even have a name. It'll be somewhere else, whatever it is. So the major category in the hierarchy of all that exists and doesn't, according to Buddhism, in my understanding, is the selfless. That which lacks a permanent self, that's everything. That's existing things, non-existing things. Do I have a permanent self? No. Do unicorns have a permanent self? No. Do unicorns exist? No. Or whatever doesn't exist. The horn of a rabbit.
I love a four-sided circle.
Mm-hmm. Like, a four-sided circle has no permanent self. So a four-sided circle is selfless. So at the top, the selfless. That gets divided into existing things and non-existence. Existence and non-existence. Then existence get divided into impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena. Permanent phenomena, I'm not going to get into extensively because it took me a while to understand imperfectly what it is. But most of the things that we think of, like, you know, look around your home, look around the room that you're in, look around the world, a tree, a pen, our glasses, our bodies, our hair, like any person that we can look at, your dog, like these are all impermanent, which an impermanence works on like different time scales. Like some things, you know, like a spark, impermanent, exists only a moment. A human life, impermanent, exists for however long a human life is, though every moment, which I understand a moment in Buddhism to be in the snap of a finger, there are either 64 or 360 moments happen in that amount of time. And in a moment, what happens is a phenomenon will arise, abide, and then fall away. So, and then the next moment will happen where, like, you know, this microphone looks like there's a microphone here constantly forever, but there's not. At a certain point, there wasn't a microphone. At a certain point, there won't be a microphone. So it came into being and it'll stop being in being. But every moment it shifts. Every moment, the molecules, all of it are being rebuilt and dissipated constantly.
So I know that 8 minutes isn't really enough time, but Buddhism is famous for talking about reincarnation, yes, or at least in stand-up comedy. Yes. And because it is a hell of a premise, the idea. And the main premise is no one thinks that they were, you know, a peon back in the 12th century. Everyone thinks that they were the king and queen. And so what is, to your understanding, in Buddhism, mm-hmm, the idea of reincarnation?
Yes, I will share that. I think that the term that they use most frequently is rebirth, that we this is a rebirth for us, a reboot of a kind, that if you go back infinitely, like that time didn't begin, that there is beginningless time. And so we have been incarnating forever until now. And that because of that infinite timeliness, we have been, you and I have been to each other every relationship possible. I have been your mother. You have been my father. We have been friends. We have been, you know, strangers. Probably most of the time we didn't know each other. The question that I asked Gus and the question that many people ask when they're like, okay, so if there's no soul, what is it that is being rebirthed, reborn, reincarnated?
Right.
If you're like, what's the thing that's the same from one life to the next? Because it's certainly not the physical material.
Right, right. And if there's no soul, this huge reveal here at 53 minutes, okay? Because you already said that there was no soul to bring that back.
Oh, yeah.
What is it?
So this answer might not be satisfying to you.
Oh, I'm sure it won't be. Let's hear it.
Yeah. So when I asked the question, I'm paraphrasing the answer I received, which works for me. Like, I'm not saying, the joke that I tell is I don't believe in reincarnation, but I think I may have in a past life. And the truth of where I am now is I've read a lot of things and learned a lot of things from Buddhists who are like, basically, you don't have to believe in reincarnation to get on board with most of Buddhism. It's true, but you don't have to believe it. And the way that the answer that Gus gave me was basically when I say, well, what is it that's reborn if there is no soul? And he says, well, what is it that's the same about who you think you are from today to when you were getting up yesterday or going to bed yesterday or last week or last year or 17 years ago or when you were a baby? Like, if your baby self is not made of the same material that you are now, and your baby self doesn't have any of the same experiences or capacities, like, your baby self looks completely different than you right now, is in so many ways completely different, other than we're like, but that's Jackie, right? That one's Jackie. Follow it for a while. It's that. Here it is. That's Jackie. But what is it that's the same about that baby to now? The same, whatever that is, that's what's reborn.
Okay. That feels like a soul to me.
I mean, that's the thing. It absolutely feels like a soul.
Yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't have to be defined as such, right? I mean,
oh no. The idea is that it's the realization of emptiness, of the emptiness of an inherent, intrinsic, permanent self. Like, that's like the big one. That's like, it's not even to say, like, if you get it, then there won't be a you to get it, you know? Like, if it's gotten that, which, and I'm not there. Like, I'm here with you. In fact, you might be there. You might be a divinely enlightened Buddha, as far as I know, and I might be the last individual non-enlightened being in the world, and everyone here is just, like, rooting for me, playing their parts to be like, go for, like, oh, maybe this will be the lifetime that he gets it. Maybe it'll be 1 trillion lifetimes from now.
The weird thing is have you ever seen an Albert Brooks Meryl Streep movie called Defending Your Life?
Love it.
Love it. On the phone, downloaded. Got the DVD, watching it.
Yes.
And it has that vibe to it, right? Where you're just like, it has that, what you just said, feel to it about what life ought to be. You keep going forward. You know, if you live in fear, you don't want to come back to Earth. You know, you want to move away from Earth because Earth is being held for beings that are in fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like the idea of that.
Oh, yeah. He's a wise, kind man. It's a beautiful movie, a wonderful story. And there's so much that I don't know about how anything works. And also, like, oh, here's one other tidbit from Buddhism that will be, you know, this is absolutely not comprehensive. Maybe we'll come back and do Tudism.
Boom. And then Buddhism. Yes.
Yeah. The thing, we'll get all the Udisms. The thing that when we think of ourself, when we think of a person, what makes a person? Well, sometimes there's what's called in Buddhism the five aggregates, and I may not get them all.
Okay.
But one of them is, I had them at one point, but and I am them. But there's the body, the physical body, the form. Then there's other things, like there's consciousness, there's like, I could look it up real fast, but anyway, there's four non-physical specific things that, like, when we think of a person, we're like, oh yeah, like I can tell that one, that's a person, that's not a person, that's one, like this differentiates this from that. And those five aggregates, we think of them as making up a person, but like the idea, my understanding of the idea is that it's an illusion because it's like the Big Dipper. Like the Big Dipper, we know what that is. It's made of seven stars, right?
Right.
So if you look at those seven stars, you're like, there's one, there's two, there's up to seven. That's the Big Dipper. But if you say, so is the Big Dipper real? Does the Big Dipper exist? Like, there's seven stars. If, like, those seven stars exist in the conventional way that they do, the Big Dipper is a name that we've given to the constellation.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that there are seven stars and the Big Dipper. It's that, does
those
that make sense?
Those seven stars make up the Big Dipper?
Yeah, those seven stars make up the Big Dipper.
In our minds.
Exactly. There is a, it is called the Big Dipper the same way that the constellation of aggregates that we are, the matter and energy, the consciousness and form, all of these things that we're like, yeah, over here, this one's Mike. This one has the constellation name, the little Miker, you know?
That's the term. Whatever the aggregates are, make up the personhood or make up the thing that we're looking at because we've named it, right? Like,
exactly.
I've named this bottle. So the So it is the form of the bottle. It is the feeling I get when I see it says bottle. I see a bottle.
Yeah. Do you remember the original or the Voltron that I grew up with that was like five lions that became one big guy that was made of five robot lions?
I've heard of it. I've never gotten into it. Yes.
So I think of like we're made of five aggregates as humans. And I feel like that is like a wonderful analogy in it might not be, but those five lions make up one guy. So we're like, wait, is it five lions or is it one guy? Be like, yeah. It, when it's all together, we're like, that's the one, that's Voltron.
Right.
But when it's all separately, we're like, yeah, those are the, that's the red lion, that's the green lion. Like, but okay, so how many things are there? We're like, yeah, that's not a, that question doesn't, infinite.
Okay. Well, for the love of the not the baby Jesus, for love of everything, it's we have talked about Buddhism for an hour, and I have anecdotally told you things tangentially that were also interesting and entertaining. Mike Kaplan, you guys, always a delight, always a delight. I get a text from every month saying, "Guess what? It's a new month," and then there's some chitter chat. I often feel like I should have responded to it, but I've decided recently I'm not going to feel obligated. So, but I know in your heart that it's always nice to get it. I forgot to ask you a thing. Should we go over?
I'm happy to go over.
Dalai Lama.
About
what is
the
it?
Recent thing?
No.
Yeah.
No, that's, but that's the guy who was reincarnated every time they find a little boy and they say,
yes,
it's the new one.
Yes. And so what's the question? Just speak in general about it.
Yeah, well, that guy's linked to Buddhism, right?
100%.
There
he
we
is
go.
The yeah. You got one. This is wonderful. Yeah.
Nailed it. It turns out whoever is holding that place card for Buddhism as the Dalai Lama is also a human adult man who would like to touch other humans, and I can't. None of us can stop it. It's fine. But
it's
we
true.
Can talk to him about it for sure.
And my understanding with the recent kerfuffle is that, like, you know, it wasn't a thing that he was trying to hide and be ashamed about, like, because, like, it was public and filmed and it was, like, my understanding is that there are cultural differences, which doesn't negate
the fact that it's a little uncomfortable for us culturally.
Absolutely. And a thing that he said a few years ago as well about if there were, he was asked if a woman could be the Dalai Lama. And I think he said she would have to be attractive. And there's probably more context for that because
but I do love that statement. That's great. Yeah. It's
but other than those two things, everything that I've heard from and about the Dalai Lama is pretty sweet. I'll tell you, here's two Dalai Lama stories. Three Dalai Lama stories that I love real quick. One, my friend Gus, the practicing Buddhist, some years ago was going to an event at which the Dalai Lama was speaking, and Gus was walking past like the storefront window that he was going to go in, made eye contact with the Dalai Lama through the window. Dalai Lama smiled a smile that made Gus say to me, he's like, I would love someday to feel as happy to see anyone or anything as it looked like he was happy to see me, a person that he'd never seen before.
That's cool.
Corollary.
Yeah.
The Dalai Lama has said he strives to greet everyone in the world as if an old friend. Which does add some additional context to when he's like, oh, so maybe we
exchange molecules.
We embrace.
Yeah.
Number two, the Dalai Lama was asked, this is a serious one, was asked about regret, I think, in an interview. And the Dalai Lama said that one time a man came to him and said, I want to practice this particular thing, whatever. I want to do this exercise. And the Dalai Lama was like, oh, that's actually, you're older and don't need to do it. That is an exercise for a younger person. So don't even worry about it. You're cool. Don't need to do that thing. That's for younger people. Sadly, I'm so sorry. This man, the older man who wanted to do the thing, killed himself.
Ooh.
Because he wanted to be reborn as a younger person who would get to do the thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
and
maybe the Dalai Lama might not be entirely sure of how much power he wields.
I mean, in that the story continues, I think you're absolutely right that he didn't and now does more.
Yeah.
And somebody asked him, the interviewer said, how did you get over that? And the Dalai Lama said, I didn't. And so that's a powerful thing that I feel like all of our, you know, we all do things that, you know, we wish we didn't, that we've said things that have hurt people's feelings. We've grabbed a bus driver by the shirt. You know, we have some things that we don't remember, but we have many things that we carry with us, at least through this life. A brief other interlude. Karma is a topic that could also be the source of a very large topic of conversation. I'll just say this, that my understanding is that karma, definitionally in Buddhism, is not what we think of it as in the West.
It's not the thing that is being told to me if I ever take yoga.
Ha ha ha. No. I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but the idea that karma is about what you deserve is a misconception for the Buddhist definition of karma. I think it simply means you're doing. Like, if I lift up this teddy bear, whose name is Fudge and belongs to my girlfriend, Rini, he's a member of our family. If I drop Fudge just very gently, very briefly onto my lap, he falls because of gravity. He didn't deserve to fall. It was just the natural consequence of my dropping him is that he fell. And that is the karma. The karma of if it goes up, it comes down. If you... like a karma of killing. For every bug that we have killed, there is a karma of killing. For any sentient being that is killed, there is a karma of killing that eventually will be reckoned with.
Because
will
it
be
happened,
worked out.
And it is like a butterfly effect kind of thing in scientific
exactly.
talk.
Okay. And sometimes these happen, you know,
so,
from lifetime to lifetime.
So what you're saying is that karma is not always a bitch. I had to say that out loud.
Yes. I mean, often, like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about watering, you know, the seeds, like you may have heard, not Buddhist thing, the wolf you feed, you know, there's two wolves at war within you.
All right.
The angry one, the happy one, which one wins?
The one
you feed. Native American story, as I understand it. A similar concept comes from Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, who says, like, if we feel anger at something, You can water the seed of anger, or you can water the seed of compassion. And whichever one you water more will be the one that grows within you and will be what you then spring to more easily. And so it's good to, like, even the Buddha has in his former lives, there's a story of him, like, killing someone to save a life, killing someone who was going to kill someone else before he was the Buddha, a Buddha. And he went to, my understanding is, a hell dimension. He came back as a hell being briefly, and, like, bounced back up to another life, like, was there very shortly, came back up. But because he killed, he had to endure the consequences of the karma of killing, even though the intent was to save other lives.
Okay.
So the Dalai Lama carries that.
Okay.
Final Dalai Lama story, maybe my favorite. I say it on stage sometimes. I'll do it to you. I believe that I can answer any question honestly and correctly. So if you want to ask me anything, I will answer it honestly and correctly.
Wow. This is a freebie, ladies and gentlemen. Unfortunately, ill-prepared. So, okay.
I can do it without you if you want.
Yeah, go for it. Why did you grow the beard?
Why did I grow the beard? Oh, the answer. So the Dalai Lama once, I like to answer the way the Dalai Lama once answered a great question. He said something like, and I'm paraphrasing, the answer, that's a good question. The answer is very simple. I don't know.
Oh.
So
that is unsatisfactory. It's good when it's, yes.
Yeah. yeah, absolutely. I don't. And that's the theme of this whole thing is they say in Buddhism, what one fool can do, any fool can do, which is nice. Final Dalai Lama story. My friend Gus likes to say, people say that the Dalai Lama is a very kind man. And they're like, but of course he's the Dalai Lama. Of course he's able to do this kind thing or that kind thing. And my friend Gus says that does a disservice to the work that the Dalai Lama has done to become the kind of person that he is, to become the specific person that he is, the practice, the seeds that he has watered. Maybe he's still not all the way there. Maybe we're not all the way there. But he said it would be like seeing somebody who had built their own house brick by brick, hammer by nail. I don't know how you build a house, but and saying like, wow, what a beautiful house that just fell from the sky. You know, like you, like, not that you're the only one that did it,
right?
But like, if you, there's work that we can do, and that it's not that the Dalai Lama is more special than anyone else. It's just that he has lived a life and done certain practices. You have lived a life and done certain practices. I have lived a life and done certain practices, and we can all advance. We can all add a few more drops to the bucket. We can all, from wherever we're starting, move a little further forward along the path in the life that we have. Like some people start with a much less, much lower capacity. That's the phrase I'm looking for there. Like, but everyone, if you're in a human incarnation, if you have, you know, the conscious ability to think and act and reflect and care and you know, you're here listening to a podcast, or being on a podcast, like we have the time, we have this precious human existence.
Make the effort.
Be able to think about what we are doing. Look at people who are doing things in ways that we do value and respect and are inspiring, be they potentially religious figures, spiritual figures. Sorry, I never answered your question about whether Buddhism is, a religion. The answer is I don't know, or yes and no, probably Schrodinger's religion. And just that what one fool can do, any fool can do. It's not that there's anyone, like there's no, it's not like in maybe Catholicism where they're like, we need to have a conduit to God to be like, here's the stuff. It's just like the information is out there. The writings are there. The Lamrim exists. The Buddhist centers, the teachers, the stories, like you can start anytime from anywhere. And also be a Buddhist or otherwise. One more Dalai Lama thing. He said, Jews be Jews, Buddhists be Buddhists. Like there's basically two paths, like every path, it's all paths up the same mountain,
yeah.
All fingers pointing at the same moon. So you don't have to be Buddhist. Even though according to my book that says to a Buddhist, everyone is Buddhist. But you don't have to be, you can be a Buddhist.
And a Mormon, everyone's a Mormon. So You can be bossy from within. And but you might as well try to be a better person, which is what I liked about this episode a great deal. Mike Kaplan is spelled M-Y-Q-K-A-P-L-A-N, and it's at Mike Kaplan on all the things. But if you use the code Mike, M-Y-Q, on his new Dry Bar special, which comes out the Thursday after this comes, which will be in the middle of May 2023, go watch that. And then in August of this year, you're going to be at the Edinburgh Festival. And your current newest album is called Live in Between Albums.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rangers of the Dork Forest, you have been listening to me and Mike Kaplan. So I thank you for that. I thank you, Mike Kaplan, for being on the show.
I thank you.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?